Before we go into our interview today, I wanted to let everyone know we have a new sponsor for our Energy Question podcast, the U.S. Oil and Gas Association, or USOGA for short. First established in 1917, USOGA has been an effective and creative voice for the industry for more than a century now. USOGA is dedicated to educating the public, policymakers, and legislators at the federal, state, and local levels about the value of the domestic oil and natural gas industry. If you're in the industry and not currently a USOGA member, please consider joining the association as a way of helping it tell your story to the policymakers whose actions impact everything you do each and every day. You can start that process by contacting USOGA through its website, usoga.org. Thanks so much to USOGA for sponsoring the Energy Question podcast, and now on with our show. Hey, welcome to the Energy Question podcast with David Blackman. I'm your host, David Blackman, and my special guest today is Tim Stewart, the president of the U.S. Oil and Gas Association, one of the finest spokesperson and advocates for the oil and gas industry in Washington, D.C. How you doing, Tim?
Dave, you're a great American. Thanks for having me on. It's good to talk
you with are. You are. Yeah, it's always great to talk with you, Tim. I really appreciate you doing this with me. And of course, there is no shortage of things to talk about in Washington. As you and I were talking about prior to starting here, things never do seem to get better out there, do they?
No, they really don't. And it's been a tough, tough fall here. I know we want to probably dive into what the sort of this mess with the reorganization of the House leadership on the Republican side and budget issues and CRs and things like that. You know, we're kind of used to seeing this movie play out, but this one is a little bit different than it has been in times past. So we got lots to dig into.
Yeah, Mike Johnson, of course, is the new speaker, a conservative Republican, kind of a MAGA kind of guy out of Shreveport, Louisiana. We never had a speaker from Shreveport, I'm sure. But he seems like a good, strong individual to take on that task, which frankly I think is an impossible job. But what do you think about him? Is your initial impression good?
Yeah, it is. You know, and again, when you start having these actually political conversations, your listeners are going to be all over the map on these things. And so let me begin with a caveat that this is sort of the gospel of Tim, you know, and it's only my my perception versus anybody else's. We may mingle some scripture in that, you know, but beyond that, it's been really interesting to watch this unfold. You know, I was thinking about this morning, David. It's one thing, you know, Pelosi had a similar margin when in the last Congress. She had 5 and McCarthy started off with 5. It's one thing to watch your margin erode down to 5 and then say, okay, we all have to hang together. It's another to take over a majority and then say, we have to hang together. And I think that was the problem that McCarthy had right from the beginning. You know, if he'd had 15 or 20, if he had a margin of 15 or 20, this wouldn't have never happened, would have been an issue. The two speakers, McCarthy was excellent on oil and gas issues. He never had any problem or any concern or any reason to worry about where he was going to lead the conference, lead the House on legislation. I think Speaker Johnson will be the same. Like you say, he comes from energy producing states, from Shreveport. He'll be good on these issues. You know, he is relatively new to Congress. You know, he's in his fourth term. Is that right?
Yeah.
And it's equivalent, you know, it's really interesting. This is like he's a deputy whip for the House members before becoming speaker. And for Republicans in the House, this is like if a CEO resigns or retires or is booted out and you pull a regional manager in to run the whole company, because that's really what the deputy whips are. They're assigned to regions. And so there's a challenge there because you haven't had enough time to get to know all of these deputy whips really well. I think we feel pretty confident, though, that given the fact he comes from such a high energy producing state of Louisiana, he's such a rock solid conservative. No concerns about where he's going to go. It's just a matter of he's got a big, big task ahead of him. The other issue is, you know, a lot of times members who rise in seniority and leadership, they develop an alumni association. They have senior staff who go out, and McCarthy's got a huge alumni association. Pelosi's got one that's decades old.
Oh my God.
You you know, Mike Johnson doesn't have much of an alumni association. So there's nobody on the outside to say, tell me how your former boss thinks or operates or things like that. So it's a relationship building challenge ahead for virtually the entire DC base. You know, it's going to be interesting times.
One of the big issues, of course, that Matt Gaetz, the congressman from Florida who led the effort to take McCarthy out of that job, that he was concerned about was this failure of McCarthy to follow through and get 12 appropriations bills done and return the House to normal order in the budgeting process. Which, of course, Johnson comes into this job, he, you know, just 3 weeks before we've got another expiration of a continuing resolution. Obviously, they're not going to get 12 appropriations bills completed and passed through the House by then. So you're looking at another CR here coming in the next couple of weeks. How important is it, though? I think it's actually pretty important for the House to return this budgeting process to normal order. And I wonder how you think about that just from the perspective of the oil and gas industry. I think it's important from our perspective as an industry.
Yeah. No. In a former life, back when I was somebody working on the Hill, you know, I actually worked for an appropriator, a Senate appropriator. And that was when things functioned. They went when the process, it was regular order. You know, you were under a race to get the appropriations bill done by the end of the fiscal year, which is September 30th. That began to erode probably around the 1996-97 timeframe. And then just that continuous erosion. There hasn't been a single appropriations bill passed on time in nearly 25 years. And the part of that problem with that, David, is you see this fiscal cliff by which we live now. We are on the very the edge of the precipice. We're going to fall over, and we can talk more about that. But one of the reasons that led to that was the fact that the budget process and the budget framework, the parameters by which Congress allocated money, those began to disappear. And you started to see supplementals, you started to see emergency supplementals, which meant all budget constraints were just off the table. And it's been fascinating to watch, particularly since COVID, when what it constitutes an emergency 10 years ago was a $4 billion supplemental, now as a $40 or $60 billion supplemental, and you do that three times a year without an actual budget in process, no wonder we're running, you know, no wonder Treasury's borrowing $800 billion a quarter now. To Johnson's point, you know, it's interesting. You're exactly right. This is how this whole mess started in the first place. You know, the call them the Shiites, call them the chaos, you know, whatever you want to call them. They were unhappy, okay? And they blew up McCarthy over a budget process that was still calcified. I don't envy Speaker Johnson because he's coming to, has to do the exact same thing as you mentioned, take on the exact same issue that brought down McCarthy. He's now saying, well, I'd really like to get it through January 1st, not have to go through this every 2 weeks between now and Christmas. Interesting point, though, you know, from the House perspective, David, I worked for both the House and the Senator. OK, I worked on the Natural Resources Committee as chief of staff for there. And I worked for a senator from Utah and did his energy and natural resources and appropriations. When I went to work for the House, the chairman of the committee who I worked for, a Republican from Utah, a great guy named Jim Hansen, you know, just an old guard, consummate legislator. He knew how to pass bills. And he said to me, he said, you need to remember something. He said, anyway, again, speaking to a Republican, he's a Republican. He said, the enemy is not the Democrats. The enemy here in the House is the Senate. That's who we have to fight. It's not I'm fighting a Democrat in the House or fighting a Democrat in the White House. I'm fighting the whole Senate itself. And that was always that he really put that into us. And that this is, again, when you're in a situation where you have a Republican House and a Democratic Senate, a Democratic White House, you're very, very constrained. And Matt Gaetz and his friends, I don't think, accepted that reality that McCarthy just could only get them so far. So interesting situation.
From the industry's perspective, I think the oversight function is so important to help, you know, because part of what Congress is supposed to do is exercise oversight over these abusive executive branch agencies who are doing stupid things like this SEC proposed regulation to force standards on ESG reporting, which is going to be incredibly destructive to the energy business in the United States if it becomes final. And if you had a real budget at SEC, an actual appropriations bill, you could have a battle over appropriations.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the Republicans could, at least in theory, hold up, prevent the SEC from spending any more money on pushing that regulatory effort. And with a continuing resolution, you just, I mean, they can hold hearings, but they have no leverage. It robs them of all that budgetary leverage, right?
Yeah. You're right. It's interesting. Some of the most powerful tools we had when we worked on the appropriations process years ago was to insert what was, you know, a prohibition on funding on the promulgation of the final rule. Yeah. So that was, to your point, that was bringing the agency right up to the point where they could think that they can get something implemented, but then Congress says, you can't implement it. We're not going to fund it. And so those are the really, really most powerful tools to have. I'm like the old guy who goes out on the porch and yells at the clouds, because I talk about how things used to be, you know. But what the other thing that happened, again, this is again waxing philosophical, you know, probably starting about 2005, 2006, when the Abramoff scandal hit and Congress unilaterally disarmed itself on the appropriations process itself. Remember earmarks and everything like that. Yeah. What ended up happening was in that race to overcorrect on appropriations and earmarks, they also surrendered their budget oversight authority over the agencies. And so the agencies now largely ignore congressional directives, even in report language or earmarks or things like that. We're in a real mess right now. Good example. You know, here's a good example. I don't know if you follow this or the listeners followed this, but Department of Transportation, you've got a Senate nominee named Ann Carlson, who is an absolute green. She's coming to the National Highway Transportation Safety, you know, to do that. But she is very much there to implement the climate agenda. And her nomination was rejected. Senate voted her down. Joe Manchin, they voted down, said, you cannot take this job. So the administration put her in an acting position instead. And so even though she was essentially fired or never hired, she still shows up to work and she still shows up and collects a paycheck. So earlier this week, Ted Cruz himself, you know, he led this amendment to make it sure that she didn't get paid. And unfortunately, you know, they lost it by two votes. But this is where the agencies largely ignore the directions of Congress. You know, if Congress says you cannot put this person in place, and the executive agency says, I'm going to do it anyway under a different capacity. It's, you know, the branches of government just don't seem to work anymore. And the budget, this whole CR extension, this whole, you know, shutdown war is a perfect example of it's a war of attrition, and it gets us nowhere.
Well, if you had to put together a list of things you would like to see the new speaker accomplish here in the near term, just on behalf of the oil and gas industry to protect us from all these abuses in the administration, I mean, what can he do? What are actions he could take that would really be helpful on that front?
Yeah. And this is where it's really the lowest common denominator, because it's one thing for the House to pass a bunch of messaging bills. It's another to actually get the Senate to agree to some of those things.
Yeah.
The speaker needs to do, if we're talking the appropriations process, the speaker needs to actually force the Senate to a conference, you know, force those Senate appropriators to sit down with House appropriators and force them to negotiate out what is and isn't the realm of the feasible between the two. Okay. That's the first thing that the speaker's really got to do if you want to fix this budget process. There are a lot of things. I mean, look, permitting bill is still alive. Okay, that's outside the budget world. We were talking with the Senate folks today. Senator Manchin, Senator Barrasso still want to get some type of permit reform, and it needs to be done. If the speaker were to make that a priority, I think that would make a big difference. That would sort of break off the scales, the mollusks, so to speak, and move the legislative process forward. But I do think in the budget process, there are some very small things that are having a huge, huge impact. You mentioned the SEC rule. That's a big thing. You know, to be able to stop that rule from going forward would be a huge win. But at the same time, embedded in every single agency budget, because we're in a continuing resolution, which means last year's budget and rules are still to apply, the things like the social justice funding and social justice sort of a policy approach that permeates every single agency. That stuff's got to be cleared out, because that serves no purpose whatsoever except to continue to generate energy poverty. I don't think a lot of us are holding out big hopes for a huge, huge legislative win outside of maybe getting permit reform. But I think you've got to dig yourself back into those appropriations bills and see what is still in place from last year when Pelosi was running the show, and dig that stuff out and stick a new stake in its heart. So,
well, that would be nice. That would all be great stuff if he could accomplish even a little bit of it. The permitting reform is obviously something that's needed to happen for a long time. And unfortunately, the language Manchin proposed at the first of the year really only addresses a small piece of the real problem. And so even if it gets passed, you still got a lot of issues out there, but it would help.
It would definitely help.
So let's move on. We had another kind of big, I think it's a big event in Louisiana. We talk about Johnson being from Shreveport. They elected a new governor, Jeff Landry, from the Lafayette area, a really good guy, a strong attorney general for a dozen years now, I think, in that state. I know you've got members from Louisiana in your organization. Are you hearing anything from them? Good things?
Jeff was, I guess the governor, we'll call him now, was great on our issues. You know, the one thing that he did, which was incredibly valuable, was he led the rest of the Republican AGs, the state attorney generals, who challenged the administration on all of their horrible regulations. He led out against the Clean Power Plan. He supported the Keystone XL pipeline, imposed, led the AGs on those legal actions. He did WOTUS. He did a lot of things. He's really, really good on these issues. And it's not surprising, so much of the, I guess if you point to the legal success that our industry can point to over the last 2.5-3 years against the Biden administration has been led not necessarily by industry, but by the Republican AGs and that strong coalition they've held together. So we're really glad that he's there. We're confident that somebody will backfill him with the same amount of zest and robust approach to taking on the hordes of orcs that are coming after our industry, we're excited for him, and he'll make a great governor.
Of course, our own attorney general here in Texas was sidelined for 6 months with this, for 4 months with this ridiculous impeachment fiasco that unfortunately was led by fellow Republicans. I'll never be able to.
I've been meaning to ask you about that.
I tell you, it's just the damnedest thing I've ever seen in my life. And it's a real stain on the Republican Party of Texas, frankly. I just not that Ken Paxton's this squeaky clean angelic guy, but you didn't really have, as was proven in the trial in the Senate, they didn't have a case. They didn't have any element of those allegations that ended up not being debunked by the defense. I mean, it was incredible watching it all play out. So I just, it's a shame, because as you mentioned, the attorney generals have been so important. So it was great to have Landry, still able to actively lead some of those efforts on behalf of the industry. I wonder, we have this methane tax that was contained in the IRA. And I was talking with a friend with one of the associations here in Texas about it earlier this week, and they're very, very concerned about the impact that may have on small producers and marginal wells, despite the obvious legislative intent and Joe Manchin's reiteration of his desire to have those particular operators kind of protected from the worst of that tax. Do you think there's any chance that you could hold that, or that these attorney generals might be able to hold up the implementation of, I know they're about to produce rules related to the enforcement of that at Treasury. Wonder if you're hearing anything about potential litigation trying to hold that up from implementation.
Yeah, you know, industry, a lot of industry groups are taking a hard look at that. And I imagine there's going to be a concerted legal strategy here going forward once the sort of the financial ramifications are held. I can't speak to the states themselves, who, if the AGs are going to bind together and do their own litigation. But I do know that there's several in our industry who are looking at, you know, that's such an interesting thing. That's a levying a tax before the rule is even actually finalized. Our industry is so good at what we do, and in particular, taking measures to increase our efficiency. And so, you look at what great progress we've had in reducing flaring, reducing venting, and things like that. And this is just, it's one of those situations. It's like all things government, David. You know, where oftentimes it is a solution in search of a problem. You know, and the government regulators are always the lagging indicator. You know, industry is so much farther ahead of them anyway. You and I can wax philosophical about all sorts of things, but if you look at the regulatory process itself, and I may have complained about this to you in times past, but it's largely become self-aware. You know, the regulatory process, like Skynet, where an outcome is deemed a threat. The whole purpose of the regulatory process is to perpetuate the process. And so, look, if you and I go into EPA, here's a good example. The number of people who are just designed to check a box in the process. If you and I are to walk into EPA with a particular issue or problem, and we're to have a meeting with EPA, we would be outnumbered in any given time. It's been my experience that I'm outnumbered probably 6-1 by the agency regulators versus me representing the industry. And the reason being is because there's so many people in that process. This methane tax is a perfect example. You know, it was never put to the industry, let's work on this together. Tell me about your new technologies. Tell me about the things that you can do so we can get behind you on that. It is, we will levy a $900 per ton tax on you. Take that up to $1,500. And while we're waiting for you to tell you what it is we want you to do, we're going to be taxing you. And by the way, if at the end, if you don't like what we do, then that's okay. So sue me. And this is the whole problem, you know, is it used to be that some agencies were so litigation averse, they were frozen. And now, Forest Service is a good example. You can't get any decision out of the Forest Service because of the process, because they're so litigation adverse. EPA, on the other hand, is very different. It's like, go ahead, sue me 17 times if you want to. I'm going ahead and do this. But this process is just designed to perpetuate itself. It's horrible in terms of good government and good for the economy and good for the consumer.
Yeah, I look at that and I agree with you. Forest Service, the difference, I think, between those two agencies, Forest Service and EPA, is the Forest Service is not almost completely populated by former employees of the NRDC and the Sierra Club like the EPA is, right? After 8 years of Obama and 3 years of this current guy, you almost have nobody at EPA who didn't at one time work for one of those radical environmental organizations. And
very much a revolving door over there. Now, if you can imagine, if I were to, in a year and a half from now, if I were to leave my job and go to BLM, for example, or BOEM, or to one of the regulatory agencies, how butchered I would be in the press for, you've embedded an oil and gas lobbyist, the fox is watching the hen house type thing, but the other side doesn't have a problem with that. It's a cottage industry.
Yeah. Well, yeah, of course, that's just the way it is. It's a battle we've always had to fight in the industry in Washington. And really even in some of the states, I wonder what other issues you're hearing from your members about. Anything you want to bring up in this episode?
Well, it's interesting. I think we're all watching what this next 14, 15 months looks like with the presidential campaign. I do think there is so much, we always say this, again, it's the old man yelling at the clouds. That's the most consequential campaign that we'll see in our lifetime. But the fact of the matter is, this one really is an inflection point. If you look at the economy right now, David, you have millions and millions of people who are living on the edge of energy poverty. Okay. And that really, really concerns me, because we are now living very much in a world where it's the haves versus the haves nots. You know, we sort of joke, it's the Hunger Games. The Capitol will never go hungry, but all the other districts will. And we have millions and millions of you know, middle-class families who are having to make really, really tough decisions on how do we meet the weekly budget? Do we go shopping for food? And how do you put gas in the car versus anything else? And if we, my CEOs are looking at, you know, what happens if things don't go the way that we need them to go, we're looking at true energy scarcity over the next 10 years. Yeah. You know, we're looking at Germany. We're looking at basically, you know, what the difference between first and third world countries is the affordability and the accessibility and the reliability of our energy system. Okay. And I look, I follow you religiously on Twitter. You and I are on the same page on this. but the fact of the matter is we are at this inflection point where if things don't go the way they need to go, we'll be looking at true scarcity and true energy poverty over the next 5 years. And that scares the bejeepers out of me.
So. Yeah, me too. And I think you're absolutely right. It's really frightening. I just as an aside, I love the Joe Rogan podcast. He interviewed Elon Musk this week. And one of the things Elon Musk said, and it's a piece of disinformation he's been spreading for several years now, that is completely false. He repeated it again, that you could power the entire United States with solar panels on a 100 by 100 square mile grid, right? Which is complete nonsense. But what he always leaves out is, and he said it just a couple of sentences later, well, of course you would need batteries. And he just throws that out there offhand, as if those batteries currently exist, as if you can build them at a scale that would reliably back up that solar power in non-ideal weather circumstances. And it's this religious exercise. It's part of the dogma of what has become a religious exercise. And we are unfortunately developing energy policy now based on the dogma of this global climate alarmist religion. And I'm like you, I have always avoided saying this next presidential election is the most important we've ever had until this year. And I think there's no question that this is the most important one we've ever had. And it's a real inflection point. So I'm glad to know you and I agree on that, at least.
Yeah, Elon Musk, it's interesting because you're right. I think he does a disservice because what that explanation of how you power the world, it just doesn't work. And no. You leave out a whole other set of equations. Well, what do you do about petrochemicals? What do you do about the thousands and thousands of consumer products? Yeah. How do you support and sustain an agricultural industry without fossil fuels? You can't do that. At the same time, he has, bless his heart, put a $44 billion bet on the ability for you and me to be actually to express our views. And so I'm a little bit torn that way, right? But it really is true. I don't think this race to Marxism and socialism in the way that the rising generation has just doesn't understand what really is at stake for themselves and for their own kids. It really is concerning to me. You probably get the same sense I do, which is people just sense something is amiss, something is wrong. And they can't, if they're not politically active, they can't quite put their finger on it, but they know something is not right. This presidential cycle is going to be like anything we've ever seen. You know, it's going to come down to just three or four states who are going to decide everything. The odds of the House flipping back to Democratic control are very high, but at the same time, the odds of the Senate flipping completely to Republican control are very high. So it's going to be a free for all. It's going to be really interesting. Yeah, it would be fun to watch if there weren't so much at stake. And now it's just, for me, it's really concerning to watch everything. So.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. That used to be the real fun part of what I do. And now it's just no fun at all, you know, trying to think through all the permutations of how this all might turn out. It's just kind of depressing at this point. But anyway, hey, man, I just want to let everyone know, Tim and I have agreed we're going to start doing this on a monthly basis, give you an update of what's happening in Washington, because it's so important. And I just think everyone needs to have a good understanding of what's really happening out there, particularly as it relates to energy. So, Tim, let everybody know where they can find you at Twitter and everywhere else.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, again, and David, I appreciate having me on because I follow and I turn to your advice. I seek you out for advice all the time. And so I can't tell you anything that you don't already know or haven't already told me. So I appreciate you having me on.
That's not true.
Your listeners really do need to know that frankly, you're sort of a national treasure when it comes to rational energy policy. I'm not blowing smoke up your skirt. You really do just a huge service for so many of us. So thank you for that.
Thanks.
Let's you and I continue to fight our battles on Twitter. US_OGA. My board, bless their hearts, has said, you go fight the fight. You say what needs to be said. The other trades are a little more, they hold back a little more than I do. And I can kind of call the shots as I see it. So the more followers, the happier we are. So come follow us on Twitter and let's go fight the battle on social media, shall we? So
absolutely. Absolutely. And folks, if you're not following USOGA's Twitter feed, you're really missing out on some really strong stuff. I look at it every day just to see what Tim's put out there most currently. Anyway, we're kind of up against the time clock, which is kind of informal here, but this has been great. I think we've gotten a lot of great information out there, Tim. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. USOGA's willingness to be a sponsor for our podcast. Really appreciate that. And we'll talk to you again in a month.
Great. Thanks, Dave. Great to be with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. And thanks to Eric Perel, our extraordinary producer, and the Sandstone Group for hosting our podcast. I'm David Blackman, and that's all for now.